did the lecturer left behind go? Is that all right? Okay. I sort of hate doing those things, but somehow it's the best thing I've done. You know, I do that halfway through them and I'm bored myself, but it's hard to be entertaining when you're talking to yourself. Well, unless you want to be committed, I suppose. Anyway, so workshops begin today, and I sent out an email sort of telling you the differences between workshop and recitation. So you signed up for a recitation because that's what the registrar calls them, but we call them workshops, so it's the same section. Does anybody have any questions about sort of how this works, what the deal is?
Actually,
yes.
Are there questions online that we have access to, or is it all
Typically, the answer is yes. What I will do is go through the problems with the PAs the week before, and then I'll try to post them. I don't actually know if I've managed to post the first workshop this time around or not yet. I was traveling last week, so lots of things sort of fell through the cracks. But typically, I'll put those there. There is not the expectation that you pull those off and work on them before you walk in. Right? It's not meant to be a race when you get into the workshop. The whole idea is really focus on how you go about understanding, debugging, your understanding things, how you set them up, the whole process. And I sort of want everybody in the room to figure it out. And if you're really fast and you got it right, work with the others. I mean, you'll be amazed how much you learn actually helping other people. So that's the idea. Now, if you find as the semester goes on that you're not getting much out of workshop because everybody else in the workshop seems to be a little quicker at it than you are, and you're embarrassed to ask questions, I mean, I sort of want you to ask questions. I understand you may not want to under those circumstances or whatever. One strategy is to actually pull those questions off and spend some time on them before you go in the workshop. So under that scenario, I sort of recommend that you might do that. And that way you get more out of it. Okay? Usually it'll be material sort of that we did the week before. Sometimes there'll be a little bit of new stuff, but it won't be too much new stuff. Okay, anything else on workshops? I updated problem set 2. As you'll see, I had to sort of ponder exactly what I wanted to do with you guys today, so I'll tell you more about that. But I added some, I think 3 problems, and maybe some practice on some of the stuff we'll talk about today. I owe you solutions to problem set 1. I'll try to get those up today or tomorrow. I did make a decision. What I was pondering was whether to use matrix formalism in introducing relativity to and do 4 vectors. And the downside to that is, for many of you, it will look very new, and relativity can get lost a little bit in the newness of the notation that we use. The upside of it is there's a reason that we use that formalism, because it makes a lot of it much clearer. And when I read Jean Coley, for example, and I'm looking at the momentum conservation piece, it's just really sort of opaque. And part of why it's opaque is he's actually working around using the formalism that we normally use. It's also, this course is a bit of a transition course, so it's actually going to be worth your while for me to drag you through the muck a little bit, because it'll be more the formalism you'll be using in lots of other classes. So I view that as part of this class. But having said that, it means that I'm planning to do more with relativity in terms of the approach and the notation than Jean Coley does. And my favorite place for relativity at this level is actually given in a textbook by Griffiths, Introduction to Electrodynamics. And that's certainly not a required book. It is on reserve in the library, but I will post a PDF of the chapter that's relevant on Blackboard, hopefully later today or tomorrow. Okay? All right, so last time, and by last time, the lecture that I gave you for last Wednesday, so I assume that you listened to it. We talked about Lorentz transformations, and this is really what relativity is all about. It's really a way of taking an observation in one reference frame and looking at and transforming it into what it would look like in any other reference frame, moving in perspective at first. Okay? And it's a little hard to overemphasize how important that is for science, right? Because science is all about observation. So relativity is really and truly, philosophically, right at the core of science. And that's sort of what it's all about. So the simplest things you can imagine measuring would be space and time, lengths and time. And we have now looked and derived, in fact, the Lorentz transformations, where you look at an event takes place at some spatial position x, y, z, and t, and in frame S, and it takes place at x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime in frame S prime, which is moving with respect to S along the x direction. And that specification is very important because, as you can see, the three spatial dimensions are not symmetric. You have a transformation really along the one. So typically you just choose one of your dimensions to be along the direction of relative motion. And typically that's it. But so relativity then gives you the relationship between these variables in the two different reference frames. So you can transform from S to S prime using these equations and from S prime to S using these equations. And one of the new things that come out, one of the new things that comes out about this, which is really pretty wild if you think about it, is that a transformation from, say, S to S prime, the position in S prime depends on the position in S as well as the time in S. And the time in S prime depends on the time and the position. So you get the space and time all mixed up just by going from one point of view to another. So space and time are no longer separate beasts in this, right? And you have all your life in Newtonian physics. You have the three immutable spatial dimensions, and you have time, and the two don't mix, right? Because time flows for everybody at the same speed. But here things get all mixed up. So it raises all sorts of problems with causality in principle. I mean, it can be a very confusing mess. But it also means that space and time are no longer separate, so we really talk about space-time, because you can literally sort of get mixed up whenever you look at it from different points of view. So those are Lorentz transformations. One wants to be able to transform any physical quantity that you might measure. So one thing that we could look at would be a velocity. And velocity turns out to be rather complex because a velocity contains a spatial piece in the numerator and a time piece in the denominator. So if we look at a velocity u in the S frame, and we then transform that into the S prime frame, basically the spatial piece transforms and the time piece transforms, each transformed as we saw in the last page. But when you throw all that together, you get a more complicated beast here. And in fact, because the transverse dimensions transform in a different way from the dimension that's along the direction of relative motion, the x component of the velocity, this equation, is a little different from these two equations. Okay? And you do sometimes have to use these, but they're sort of, they look a little different from the space-time. Now, we talked a little bit last time at the end about the so-called proper velocity, where I basically manufacture something that transforms in the same way that space does by taking the denominator here, and instead of making it a variable, I actually create something fixed out of it. So instead of using time as the variable here, I use proper time is the variable, and proper time is a proper time interval is fixed because it is defined in only one reference frame, which is the reference frame where the event is at rest. Okay, so if I have a particle that is at rest in a reference frame and it has a certain lifetime, that number is fixed. And I can look at that particle from any other reference frame, and that amount of time will look all warped, right? Because we have time dilation. So it will look different from every other reference frame, but it's always a fixed number in the frame where it's at rest. So that's the property. So we define a different sort of velocity, which we call the proper velocity. And I'm going to come back to it, but the example I think I used last time, it sort of makes sense if you're traveling, for example, if you're traveling on a plane across the country, and what's relevant to you is whether you're hungry or not when you land, then the thing that's important to you is how far do you go across the country, and how much time elapses for you on the airplane, which is different from how much time is elapsing on the ground. Okay, so this is really sort of a different beast. Now, why we're doing this will, I hope, be obvious in a little while. But what I'd like to do, well, let me ask you, any questions on this stuff so far? Okay, so now what I want to do is to sort of introduce a whole new set of notation for this. So how many of you have actually multiplied matrices before? Okay, so a lot of you. Alright, so this is something where my guess is many of you haven't seen it, some of you have seen it. So what I want to do is just be patient if you've seen it. I want to show you a little bit about matrix multiplication, sort of the mechanics of it. This isn't a math course, so we're not going to do a lot of epsilon delta crap. So a matrix really is just a collection of numbers, or quantities, whatever, and you arrange them into rows and columns. So generally you talk about a particular element in the matrix as having two indices, and the first index gives you the row number, and the second index gives you the column number. So you can imagine having two matrices, with four elements, just as an example, A11, A12, A21, A22. So I increment the second one, because I'm incrementing which column I'm in as I go from here to here, and I increment the first index when I go from this row down to that row. Same for this piece, okay? And if I want to multiply these two things, then what you do, I don't know if this works, let me try it a different way. What you basically do is you take these two elements of the first vector, you rotate them such that this multiplies that and this multiplies that. You add them together, and that becomes this first element. Then you take that same row, and you do exactly the same operation, but now on the second column. So here I have A11 times B11 plus A12 times B12, B21, sorry. And now to get the next element over here, I take this row, and I multiply it by that column, and add those two terms together. Then to get the bottom, I take the next row down, and I multiply it by the first column, and to get this term, I take this column, and I multiply it by the second column. Alright, so it's actually really easy to do once you get used to it. If you haven't seen it before, you'll probably want to practice it a little bit, but so I tried to then throw it all together in one. So this component comes from these two multiplying those two pieces and added together. This one comes from these two multiplying these two pieces added together. This one comes from these two multiplying those two pieces added together, and this one will come from these two multiplying those two pieces added together. Got that? Alright. I don't know how to teach that nicely, so we're just going to do one. All right, so let's imagine that we have these 2x2 matrices, which are just numbers, and we want to multiply them together. So this element is the first row multiplied by the first column with the two terms added together. So it would be a 6 times 1, which is 6, plus a 3 times a 3, which is 9. So that's 6 plus 9, which is 15. This term is going to be this row times the second column. So 6 times minus 1, minus 6. 3 times 4, which is 12. So this will be just 6. This piece is the second row times the first column. So that would be 4 times 1 plus 2 times 3. 4 plus 6 is 10. And then this last piece is going to be the second row times the second column. So 4 times minus 1, minus 4, plus 2 times 4, which is 8. Okay? So that is basically how you do it. Now there's nothing special about 2x2 except it's easy to see. But one of the powerful things about matrices, and the reason why we're starting to get into it, is you may have already grasped that physics is a lot easier if you're using vectors. Right? If you want to describe where something is, it takes 3 numbers to do it. And it turns out that you have these 3 orthogonal dimensions, and so Newtonian physics works really, really well when you use vectors. But other things that you may do may want more numbers rather than just 3. In fact, you've already seen with space and time that 3 spatial dimensions mix up with time. So you may imagine that it's a foursome that we want to deal with. You'll find that as you look at more complex systems, you often want to describe things using many, many different numbers. And so we describe them by these called tensors that are really described by matrices. A vector is really a simple tensor. So
you'll be doing matrices out the wazoo in time. So this is
what happens if things are a little more complex. You could have an n by m matrix multiplying an m by q matrix. The constraint is that the number of elements in this row has to equal to the number of elements in these columns. Right, because otherwise you can't get a one-to-one mapping when you pull the rows over and multiply them by the columns. So the multiplication is ill-defined if those indices don't match. But otherwise, you can take an n by m and multiply by an n by q, and when you do that, you'll end up with an n by q matrix over here. Okay, and so here's sort of a generalization, which I probably won't for you with right now, but you can look at it. Okay, so you take this column and you multiply it. You take this row and you multiply it by that column, you'll get this term, adding all those terms, all those little pieces together. So that would be sort of the general thing. So there's nothing really special about the 2x2 or the 1x3 or the 3x1 or whatever, except for you can use any of these, you just have to pull out the one that actually matches the physics that you're trying to describe. So you're very used to vectors. So vectors you can describe as a 1x3 or a 3x1 matrix. Okay? And in fact, you can do the dot product by multiplying the two vectors together like this. Now the orientations, you may wonder, well, how do you know to do it one way or the other? You basically do it in such a way that you can make the mapping work. There's a more formal way of saying that, I think, but we won't worry about it. But the vector dot product, for example, is taking one vector and multiplying it by another. And so if you have that in matrix form, that would be this row times that column, sum the terms. So AX times BX plus AY times BY plus AZ times BZ. And lo and behold, that's the dot product. Right? So you've seen that before. So
so we can take the formalism of matrices and do everything that we do with vectors. It's just vectors are simple enough to sort of do it without the matrices. In a sense, it's easier to typically do with the three components and not worry about the matrix formalism. But we're sort of reached a point where that's less true in relativity as we begin to move away from space-time. So what I want to do is introduce four vectors in relativity for you. So what I'd like to do, we've already seen that space and time get mixed up. So what I'd like to do is to create a vector-like object that contains four components instead of the three that you're used to. And we'll call it a four vector. And you may find that different books will use different notations in terms of how they do this. But what I want to do is to define the zeroth component to be time. So I'll use a general symbol of x for the four vector, and I will use a subscript to give you what component it is. So x0 I'm going to define as ct. x1 is going to be defined as just my x. x2 is going to be defined as y. And x3 will be defined as c. And in general, the four vector will be called x mu, where mu will be the... So generally, I would just refer to it as x to mu. And if that's x to mu, that means it has into those four components. And you have to sort of understand that that represents each of these in turn. Okay? Now, if I have this definition, then it turns out that it's a convenient way to do Lorentz transformations. What I'd like to do is to take this four vector, which represents the spatial piece and the time piece in the S frame, and transform it into the same thing but now in the prime frame. Okay? And I can do that by multiplying it by a matrix has the following form.
So 4x4 matrix.
Yep. And this is what we call the Lorentz transformation matrix. So let's look at that for a moment so I can convince you that this makes sense. This really represents four separate equations, right? This represents this piece times those four gives you that component, right? So if I just look at that, I have that x0 prime is equal to gamma times x0. Take this and multiply it by that, minus gamma beta times x1, plus 0 times x2, plus 0 times x3. So this is one of the equations representing this matrix. So there are four different equations. We'll do all four. But let's look at this one for a moment. X0, remember, is what we call CCT, okay? So on the left-hand side, this is CT prime. C is a constant, so it doesn't get primed. The T is prime in the prime system. Times gamma CT, now unprimed, minus beta, gamma times beta, x1 represents x. Okay? So this is gamma I'm going to pull out a C everywhere, actually, let me. So if I divide through by C, I have T prime is equal to gamma times T minus. Remember that beta is equal to V over C. So beta divided by C is equal to V over C squared. So this would be, I pulled the gamma out, so this is V over C squared X. And that should look familiar to you. We go back up and we do, way back when we were doing the Lorentz transformations, gamma times T minus V over C squared X. Gamma times T minus V over C squared X. Okay. So the time transformation is given by the first equation that's held in that matrix multiplication. So if we look at the second one, we have x1 prime is equal to minus gamma beta times x0 plus gamma times x1 plus two zeros. Oh. Hard to do. Can't both write on it and see it on the page above. So we have x1 prime is equal to minus gamma beta times x0 plus gamma times x1, and then we have two zeros. X1 prime is what we had as x prime. That's equal to minus gamma beta, x0 is ct, plus gamma x. So this is equal to gamma times x minus bt, which is the transformation we had for the spatial coordinate. Now if you look at the other two equations, we have x2 prime is y prime. That's going to be equal to 0 times x0 times 0 plus 0 times x1 plus 1 times x2, which is y, plus 0 times x3. So we have y prime is equal to y. And similarly, we have z prime is equal to z. Yes?
Now this is all dependent on the reference frame velocity being in x1. Right?
It is.
So and if that's changed from x1 to say x2, I don't know how you do that. But would that just push the gamma beta term over one down one and then just swap
it? Yeah. Yeah, so in fact, nice segue. That was exactly what I was about to start with. Well, I've made some choices here. So one choice I've made is exactly the point that he just brought up, which is the direction of relative motion in this case I've defined to be along the x-axis. Okay? In fact, I've defined it to be positive. The other thing I've done is I have defined my zero component to be the time piece. You could imagine having a 1, 2, 3, and a 4 and having the time somewhere else, right? So this is sort of a choice that I made. And once you've made the choice, we call that the metric. It's sort of the convention that you're using for the problem. And you can do relativity, you can do this in different metrics. So for example, if we had things moving along y, then it would change that Lorentz transformation matrix appropriately. Okay? All right, so a moment ago we looked at a dot product for three vectors. And we got a number. And when you multiply the two vectors in this way, you get a different sort of quantity over here. Right? These each are sets of three numbers. They can contain a magnitude and a direction, for example. The dot product is just a number. So physically, this has a different characteristic from the other two. And one of the things that's very important here, which I won't get carried away on this, if you think of a vector, all right, it has a very particular definition in a frame of reference. If I look at it in a frame of reference that's rotated with respect to the first, right, so if we have the x-axis along the floor and the y-axis going straight up, and we ask what are the components of this vector, right, we'll get certain components. If I now take it and I define my x-axis to be sort of in some weird direction, and my y-axis orthogonal to that, and I ask what are the components of that same vector in that new reference system, they'll be totally different. So the vector in and of itself is not rotationally invariant. But its magnitude is, and in fact the dot product of two vectors is, because that's just a number. So once I have this as a number, it doesn't actually matter whether I'm in this coordinate system or that coordinate system. So that's rotationally invariant. And that's a very special sort of quantity. You'll see much more about rotations and things like that in time. I'm not going to do very much with it in this class. That's maybe all we do. But the reason I bring it up is because we have a comparable thing for four vectors in relativity. If I take a four vector and I dot it into, and I multiply it by itself, for example, or another four vector, I get a quantity that is invariant. We say it's Lorentz invariant. It doesn't matter what reference frame you're in, it will look the same. Okay? And those sort of are the linchpins that you use to untangle relativity problems, because those are the pieces that don't change as you move from one reference frame to another. So they turn out to be very important. Okay, so you've seen if you have A and B vectors, then A dot B is equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the cosine of the angle between them. And as I say, it doesn't matter what reference frame you're in terms of rotationally, those will all be the same. And you end up with just a number. We have a similar thing with four vectors. So if I have four vectors, let's say that I have four vectors A and B, okay? Then it turns out the dot product for two four vectors is a little different from what you've seen with three vectors. Part of it is the same. So we would have the two x components multiplied by each other. So I'd have a1 times the b1 and the two y components, a2 times the b2 and the two z components, a3 times b3. But it turns out that the zeroth component, the a0 times the b0 for four vectors, comes in with a minus sign. It's a little bit weird, but you just sort of have to keep that in mind. Okay, so when you do the dot product for four vectors, it's like the dot product for three vectors, except that fourth component, the zeroth component for the convention we're using, comes in with a minus sign. Yes?
too complicated.
No, don't let me... Yeah, that's it. It's too complicated. Young people need their minds to never understand something so complicated. Quite honestly, I think I've known, but I've totally forgotten. That was the source of my hesitation, was like, geez, do I remember that? No, I don't know. That's a good question. I may even try to find time to figure that out for the next class. Okay. So let us create a quantity using four vectors and the dot product. That is an interesting quantity. We're going to imagine that we have two four vectors, an A mu and a B mu. Okay? And what I'd like to do is to just look at the difference of these two four vectors. I'm going to create a new vector, delta X mu, which is equal to A mu minus B mu. So that will be a four vector, which is going to be A0 minus B0, A1 minus B1, A2 minus B2, and A3 minus B3. Okay? And what I'd like to do is to take this strange quantity, which is really like a vector difference between these two four vectors, and I want to multiply it by itself. Generally speaking, when you do these kinds of things, it's a little bit the reason that you turn the vector from this way to that way when you're multiplying them together. The indices actually change locations. I'm going to pretty much ignore that in this class, but if you're a mathematics aficionado, don't get mad at me for blowing that off a little bit, and don't get too hung up on it. If you do read Griffiths, he does talk a little bit about that, and you may find it useful. But for the most part, I'm not going to worry about it. Anyway, we're going to take these two and multiply them together, so I'm going to do the dot product basically of the four vector into itself. So that means we'll have a minus A0 minus B0 squared plus A1 minus B1 squared plus A2 minus B2 squared plus A3 minus B3 squared. This is literally the spatial displacement in the three vector pieces. Right, this would be the difference in the x components squared, the difference in the y components squared, the difference in the z components squared. So this piece, if we were dealing with three vectors, would be the length of the vector, which is the difference between the two three vectors. So it would be, if you have two vectors with their tips out in free space, right, you would subtract them, and it would be the length of that vector. And then we have this piece, which is a difference in the time. So if I have two events which happen at space and times which are given by these two four vectors, okay, so I have two separate events that happen at a sub x, a sub y, a sub z, the t associated with the a four vector, and similar for the b four vector, then this piece is
the time difference squared with the c in there because we've defined the x0 component to be c times t. And this is just the spatial distance between those two events. Okay? This now is Lorentz invariant because we've done this dot product of these two different four vectors. And it's called the invariant interval. How come what? So now look at this. Guys, look at this thing. This characterizes how far light travels in the time delta t. This is how far apart those two things are. If C delta t is bigger than d, then the invariant interval is negative. If C delta t is smaller than d, then the invariant interval is positive. Okay? So this actually tells you whether these two things can possibly causally connect or not. So what we say is that if the invariant interval is negative, then we say that the two events are time-like. And if it's positive, then we say that they're space-like. And if it's zero, then we say that it's light-like, I think. My notes are wrong here. So last time I drew coordinates, position coordinate, and CT this way, and we have now right here, and on these axes, light will move at 45 degrees. And we call this the light cone. And if you are time-like, then what it means is that light can go farther than the two events are separated. Okay? Which means you, in principle, you could send a signal from one event to the other, and you could be causally connected.
So time-like events are in this region. And so here is a region where you, in principle, can be causally connected. You may not be causally connected. I mean, not every event that is within this realm causes some other event, right? But in principle, you could be, yes.
So that quantity is c squared delta t squared, and the distance of light travels
the square of it, yeah.
Doesn't c squared delta t squared happen as a meter squared?
Right, so the square root of distance would be meter square. I was forgetting the square.
So when this limit so be is meter square, which is a typical distance.
Yeah, but the distance is squared too, so in a sense, the comparison still would.
What would it be?
If light goes a distance c times delta t, if that distance is bigger than d, then I can be causally connected. If that distance is smaller than d, then I don't. So because it's they're both squared. So.
Is that because you're taking the thought process of looking at themselves?
Yeah, I mean that's where it comes in. I mean this is how it's defined, and in terms of trying to make it make some sense, I'm sort of not worried about the square so much. If I talk about the squares of the distances, it just it seems confusing to me. So, but yeah, this is how it's defined, and you are squaring the two things, so that's what the square is meant.
Okay, so if you're space-like, then it means that the distance piece is bigger than the C delta T piece, because you're positive. And so that means that the X piece here is bigger than the CT piece, so you're out here somewhere, or over here somewhere. And so if you're space-like, then you're going to be somewhere in this region, and now, the two events happen so far apart that light can't travel from one to the other before they happen. Okay. And so here you have no causal connection. And remember, I mean, I mentioned it, the fact that you're in this region doesn't necessarily mean you're causally connected, but it means in principle you can be. What that means is that when you look at these two different events, we saw last time that if I have two events that happen and I look at it from different reference frames, remember that I'm mixing up space and time. So if you are in this region, if it's time-like, you will find that for those two events, you will never be able to change the ordering of them by choosing a different reference frame. If you're over here, it turns out there are reference frames you can find which will actually flip the order of those events, which is another way of thinking about the fact that it can't be causally connected. If something can be causally connected, you can't possibly flip the orders of the events. Right. So it is certainly true that space and time get all mixed up when you do Lorentz transformation, but it doesn't mean you've thrown causality out the window, because the ordering will not change if, in fact, they are close enough that light could have traveled from one to the other.
Yes. Where's the light like?
The light-like region would be the cone itself. That would be called your light cone. Yeah, I mean the light travels from one point to another, so if the event is the detection of a light pulse, I guess it would be something like that. Okay, so my guess is, sitting where you're sitting,
And in fact, I was a little torn on this. It isn't obvious why we go through all this hassle of four vectors and stuff at this point. I mean, what is it saving us so far? We actually already had all this stuff pretty much before we started today. I actually find that it's much easier to sort of deal with momentum conservation when you have four vectors. So that's what all this was really about. So we want to be able to transform anything from one reference frame to another. So that means we have to look at the various conservation laws that we're used to and ask, is there a relativistic form of it that works? And what are the various quantities that can transform? And so one of the ones that's pretty fun to look at is momentum conservation. So I'd like to look at that for a minute. And so let's suppose that we have two masses, say A and B, that collide. So if we look at, let me say that we have reference frame S and S prime, and I'm going to have S prime moving with respect to S at V, and we'll say along the x-axis. And let me in fact look at a momentum conservation problem, but just for simplicity, let's only worry about the x component for the moment. So let's suppose that we have two objects that collide, mass A, and we'll give it a velocity UA, and I won't bother with the X because we'll just worry about things in the X for the moment. Collides with mass B times UB, and that's going to have to be equal to whatever, let's suppose they collide maybe in, elastically, it doesn't really matter, but they, what comes out are masses C and D. So a mass UC plus mass D, which is moving at U sub D. Okay? And so this would be a statement if I have such a situation where I have two balls come in and two balls go out or whatever all along X. Or this would be a statement of momentum conservation as per Newton and stuff. So you're used to that. So now, we can ask, does momentum conservation hold true if we transform to S prime? And if the answer is yes, then you can argue that momentum is conserved relativistically. Okay? So, how do we do that? We have to transform each of the velocities. And then it's a question of whether it actually works. And so if we look at what this is, we know how x velocities transform as we go from one frame to another. So this becomes m sub a times ua minus b over 1 minus v over c squared ua plus the same for b. And that's equal, perhaps, to the same thing for C's and D's. And
I hope you look at that and go, yeah, right? That's a mess. And it isn't, it actually doesn't work. So that's not really an acceptable situation because momentum conservation is pretty useful. And we would like for momentum and energy conservation to work relativistically. In fact, it really sort of has to.
So now the trick is to try to figure out how to make it work in relativity. So remember, I mean, if we look at this, what makes it so nasty, remember when we deal with velocities, whenever you do a transformation for velocity, this looks so nasty because it comes in with a spatial piece on top and a time piece on the bottom, and they both transform, and that's what makes it so nasty. So one thing to think about doing, besides putting new batteries in that, would be to actually try to dream up a velocity where you have only one component that transforms. And so that's what proper velocity is all about. So let us define something which we'll call a proper velocity four vector. So in the proper velocity four vector, the zeroth component is going to be equal to c times dt over d tau. Remember that when we talked about proper velocity was equal to gamma times v, if you recall. So if we take the derivative of the spatial piece with respect to tau, then you basically get the proper velocity four vector. So c, remember that the fourth component, or the zeroth component for the spatial four vector, space-time four vector, is just ct. So I now take the derivative of that with respect to tau and get this. And now, remember, this is time in one reference frame. This is proper time. So this is like sam and sal. They're related by a gamma. So relative to this, we have time diluted by a factor of gamma. So this is equal to c times gamma. Dt is equal to gamma d tau. D tau is the time shortest in the proper frame, multiplied by gamma to get dt. So dt over d tau is going to be equal to gamma. So a to 0 is equal to c gamma. A to 1 is equal to dx over d tau, which is the same thing as gamma v in the x. A to 2 is equal to dy over d tau, which is the same thing as gamma by. And A to 3 is equal to dz over d tau, which is equal to gamma times bz. Okay? So that would be our momentum, our proper velocity four vector. And what I'd like to do to think about momentum conservation is, instead of using regular velocity, what I'd like to do is to use this velocity and see what happens. So if we think about what we mean when we say momentum conservation, if we only worry about x for simplicity here, then what we're saying is that ma times eta a1, which is the velocity component along the x, okay, so this would be a statement of momentum conservation in the S frame. So then the question is, with this definition of momentum, calling it, you know, mass times the 4 vector, I'm going to kill myself here. The question is, if I now transform this, is momentum conservation also true in the prime frame? So let's look at it in the S prime frame. And the question is whether this is true, because if this is true, then momentum conservation works relativistically by this definition of momentum. You okay with that? So this is really what we're asking. So now what I want to do is to actually look at what these eta primes are. If we go back and we look at the proper velocity 4 vector, it transforms like space does, space time, because all I have is the this top piece. So I should have the same Lorentz transformation. So that means that eta 0 prime, eta 1 prime, eta 2 prime, eta 3 prime, that 4 vector is equal to the Lorentz transformation times the unprime. Whether I have an eta or an m, you're going to have to figure out by context, because you can't tell from how I write it half the time. Sorry about that. All right, so this is how the proper time transforms. So if we now look at how the eta prime, remember this expression that we're dealing with down here has a bunch of eta 1 primes. So if we use the transformation that we have up here, eta 1 prime is equal to minus gamma beta eta 0, right, because I'm looking for this, so that means I'm taking this row and I'm multiplying it by these. So I have minus gamma beta times eta 0 plus gamma times eta 1. So I just want to put this off to the side so that I remember that I've got it. All right. And so now we have this thing, and we want to substitute in. Okay. So I now have MA. Now I want to substitute in for this eta prime. But what I'd like to do is to actually Well, let me think about how I want to do it. I guess it doesn't matter. There's a couple of different ways you can do it here. But what I want to do now is to actually substitute in for what this is according to that. So I have MA times minus gamma beta eta A0 plus gamma eta A1 plus MB. And I have similar stuff for MB. And I've substituted in for what they are in the unprimed train. And if you look at this, I'm going to pull out each of the gamma terms first, and then I'm going to regroup it in terms of gamma terms and then the, or maybe in terms of the A1 terms, or the 1 terms and the 0 terms. So, we have M sub A times gamma eta A1 plus M sub B times gamma eta B1 plus, oops, and on the other side, we will have an M sub C gamma eta C1 plus an M sub D times gamma eta D1. And then we have other terms, which are the other terms. But what I want to do is to show you that there's the gamma multiplies everything here, so we can just pull the gamma out. And if we take away the gamma, the 4 terms of the 8 that go into this equation that I have so far on this side, are equal to this. Right? It's MA times A to A1, MB A to B1, MC A to C1, MD A to D1. So when I pull this term is set equal to that term and that term, I end up with these pieces, and this we know so far to be true because momentum conservation holds in S. That's our hypothesis from the start. Okay? So what that means is momentum conservation as a whole will hold true if I take the other terms and they're equal to each other. So the other terms, I'll just put in orange for clarity. M sub A, we get a minus sign, yeah? Oops. Minus M sub A times gamma beta eta A0 minus M sub B times gamma beta eta B0. And over here we have minus M sub C gamma beta eta 0, eta C 0, minus M sub D gamma beta times eta D 0. So this whole thing I've really rewritten as this side is equal to that side, and then it's a question mark, are they? And from momentum conservation in the S system, these terms are equal to those terms. So then the real question is, are these terms equal to those terms? So that's really what we're after. So if we look at this, we have a gamma and beta everywhere. So we can just throw those out. And the minus signs we can throw out. So we have m sub a times eta a0 plus m sub b times eta b0 is equal to m sub c times eta c0 plus m sub d times eta d zero. So for momentum conservation to hold true, we need to choose this zero component appropriately. Okay? And eta zero, we've seen, is just C gamma. So we have m sub a times c gamma plus m sub b times c gamma, etc. Through by c square and define this as relativistic energy. So I have m sub a times c squared gamma plus, okay, so we do that to all the terms. And what I want to do is to define gamma mc squared as relativistic energy. And so basically what I've shown you with the caveat of the C that I'm throwing in my definition of energy, this piece that we pulled out is energy conservation, and the other piece is sort of momentum conservation. Together they sort of, if you define them together, you have sort of this relativistic momentum energy conservation. And so if we've defined relativistic energy as this gamma mc squared, then what I'd like to do is to say that we then have relativistic momentum and energy conservation if we define the following four vector as P0 is equal to M eta 0, which is M times gamma C. Remember, eta is just gamma, eta 0 is gamma C, which is equal to M gamma C squared divided by C. So I'm just pulling in a C over C, which is equal to the energy, the relativistic energy as we've defined it, divided by C. P1 is equal to M times eta 1. P2 is equal to M times eta 2. And P3 is equal to M times eta 3. So if we define the relativistic energy as we have, and we create four vector out of this relativistic energy divided by C, and momentum where we have used the mass times the four velocity instead of regular velocity, then
we have relativistic momentum and energy conservation that holds in from one reference frame to another. So the law of momentum conservation works if we define it as a coordinate. Okay, so lots of background stuff. Sorry, it's a little bit slow when I'm doing so much crud here. Any questions on this so far? It sucks. I'm about 5 minutes from the punchline, so oh well. We're out of time. Okay.